This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun. We're recording this episode of Roughly Speaking on the final day of the 2018 Baltimore Book Festival at the Inner Harbor, where I had a chance to spend some time with Earl Swift. Earl is the author of a new book about an island in the Chesapeake Bay facing an existential challenge. The book is Chesapeake Requiem, about the year Earl Swift spent with the families of vanishing Tangier Island. First, this message from our sponsor.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
Award-winning journalist Earl Swift spent more than a year living on or visiting Tangier Island in the Virginia waters of the Chesapeake. Journalists have been visiting the place for decades to chronicle the life of the crabbers and oystermen who live there, and in recent years draw attention to a dire environmental reality. The island is slowly disappearing. It's a sliver of mud and marsh where under 500 people live now. Tangier leaders believe wave erosion is what's causing the island to lose ground, and they believe a seawall all around the island will save it for years to come. Scientists believe otherwise, that a combination of sea level rise and sinking land will make Tangier uninhabitable in the next 25 years. A phone call in June 2017 from President Trump to the island's mayor drew national attention to Tangier. It also drew ridicule. The islanders are big Trump supporters, and Trump, of course, has called global warming a hoax and pulled the United States out of an international agreement to combat climate change.
Tangier Island is home to about 500 people, and people there say erosion is the biggest problem, and they want the president's help before it's too late.
Tangier produces an estimated 13% of the bay's prized blue crabs, more than any other town in Virginia.
My father was a crabber, my grandfather before him, and great-grandfather.
James Eskridge is the mayor of Tangier. His family has been here for generations. They've watched it gradually sink under the waves.
If we get a severe nor'easter or something, you can make a mark where the shoreline is, and after the storm you go out there and the mark is well offshore.
It's happening that fast.
Happening that fast.
Since 1850, the island has lost 66% of its land. In about 100 years, it's all expected to be underwater. Evacuation of the island could begin in the next two decades.
Do you think if the president told Congress, I want to save Tangier Island, it would be saved?
I do. I do indeed.
87% of the island's residents voted for Mr. Trump. Eskridge says that's in part because of his pledge to cut federal regulations. In June, the president took notice of the island's support and gave the mayor a call.
We have been discussing sea level rise, and he said Tangier's been here for hundreds of years and it'll be here for hundreds more.
Trump called the mayor of Tangier and told him not to worry about his rapidly disappearing island. Trump told him, your island has been there for hundreds of years, and I believe your island will be there for hundreds more. Now, in the unlikely event that Donald Trump's words didn't calm residents of the soon-to-be-lost city of Tangier, their mayor believes there is a solution to coastal erosion. They need a jetty or perhaps even a seawall around the entire island, and that Trump will cut through red tape and get them that wall. Yes, Trump is going to get them that wall and then make the ocean pay for it.
That, of course, was Stephen Colbert making Trump and Tangier the subject of his monologue a year ago. Samantha Bee's Full Frontal got into the act, too, dispatching the comedy show's Alana Henkin to challenge the mayor and other islanders on their beliefs about what's causing Tangier's problems.
Welcome back to the show. Last week, Syria joined the Paris Climate Accord, leaving America the only country not signed on after Trump pulled out. Trump supporters doubt climate science, too, even those who are feeling its effects in their own backyards. Alana Harkin took a voyage to meet them.
You see this island here? This wasn't an island. This was all connected. So you can see within a year's time how much land disappeared.
Do you think it's because the sea level was rising?
Nope. It's because of erosion.
I really like James Eskridge, the mayor of Tangier Island. Down here, they call him Uker. And all day, I've been trying to convince him that global warming is real.
I don't believe it.
A tiny speck in Chesapeake Bay, Tangier is home to a small and very religious community of hardy crabbers. Tangier is rapidly disappearing into the Chesapeake because of sea level rise.
Erosion, not sea level rise.
No, sea level rise caused by global warming.
That's the biggest hoax ever was.
No!
Climate change is real.
No way, honey. You could never change my mind.
That's because as evangelicals, they're among those Americans least likely to believe in climate change.
They attribute it to all to erosion.
Erosion that islanders say can be solved with a seawall.
A seawall would protect us from whatever's going on.
A wall will help with wave erosion, but it won't help as sea levels continue to rise. Did I convince anyone here? Probably not. But did we listen to each other? Sort of.
This is such a great place. It's too bad what's happened because of all the, you know, the sea level rising.
The wave erosion.
Sea rise.
Wave erosion.
The sea level is rising.
And the wave action is coming in.
We are at the Baltimore Book Festival with Earl Swift, a journalist and author who immersed himself in the life of Tangier for his elegiac book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. Have you found, since you published the book and started talking about it in public a little bit, that people are pretty savvy at Tangier? They know the Tangier story, if only because of the exchange between the mayor and Trump last year?
Well, I think there are probably quite a few people in the Mid-Atlantic who have long known about Tangier. And it's been the object of intrigue, of curiosity for generations, for folks in the Bay Country. But yeah, since June of 2017, when the mayor, Uker Eskridge, first declared that he loved the president as much as members of his own family, and then 3 days later when the president called Uker and assured him that Tangier had been there for hundreds of years and would be there for hundreds more, it's definitely moved into the kind of the forebrain of the public at large to a degree that it's never enjoyed in the past.
So when you talk about it in public, say at the book festival here in Baltimore, people kind of know the story. They've heard that it's a sinking island, and there's some questions about whether we save it or not.
Even if they don't know about its existential dilemma, you know, its current troubles, what I found is that an awful lot of people know that it is among the most remote communities in the lower 48, certainly in the East. And I think that that's really the source of fascination. This is a place that while only 80 miles from Baltimore, 100 miles from D.C., is so isolated and has been for so long that it has its own style of speech that you'd be hard-pressed to be able to pick apart if you didn't tune your ear to it if you didn't have the advantage I did of being able to listen to it for months on end and be able to decipher it. And I think that isolated communities have an appeal of their own. There's a little bit of the end of the rotor in all of us, and Tangier's is so extreme, and the people there live in conditions that are so open to the whims of nature that I think there's a lot of romance associated with the place, and that's really what they know about it. That's what brings them to the book. It's the fact that there is a story unfolding there, which is big and tragic, and really speaks to the rest of us. Has a lesson for millions of us over the next few decades is new, I think, to most people coming to the story.
The phrase climate change refugees is something I hadn't pondered until I read a book about the possibility, the potential for climate change refugees all around the world. We could see climate change refugees coming off of Tangier.
Oh, yeah. And before we'll see them from virtually anywhere else. And I mean, this is the same scientists who coined that phrase at the tail end of a 2015 report on Tangier's dilemma gave them 25 years to settle their affairs, as they say. And they could be saved with heroic intervention, but we're talking about a town of 460 people, which is facing demographic issues of its own. It's suffering really an erosion from within as well as from without. So, it becomes less attractive as a candidate for big spending all the time. Yeah.
When you consider that 25-year prediction, and when you're on Tangier, when you're walking around there, because there's so many points in your book when you're just sort of walking around observing and reflecting on what you see in front of you, Is it fairly easy to imagine this place disappearing in 25 years or being uninhabitable?
The last time I was there a couple of weeks ago, just before the hurricane, you know, bounced up the coast, there was a mild northeaster blowing, and the tide came up at the same time. There was an astronomical high tide, and that combination of east wind and high tide brought the water up in the middle of the island to waist high. And so, yeah, I mean, you could see the future, really, in that few hours that the tide was at its peak. It actually came up so quickly that the entire congregation at Swain Memorial United Methodist was marooned in the church. It came up during the service on Sunday. And, yeah, there are a lot of folks in Tangier and in that church who were in their 90s and late 80s. And so it was a dilemma. You had all these really old, kind of infirm people unable to get out of the church. When you see the island rendered impassable, big pieces of it like that, over a minor weather event, it's not too hard to extrapolate what it's going to look like a few years from now when it just continue, you know, it's had time to continue dissolving into the bay.
I'm curious about the work of the journalist who immerses himself in a place in order to get the story. Those folks got to know you a little bit over the years because you went there as a newspaper reporter. So some of them knew you. You weren't a complete newcomer and you weren't parachuting in for a day. You were going to immerse yourself in Tangier.
Tangier has been visited by reporters since the 1890s, and so the island's pretty savvy to the reporter who shows up for a day, maybe stays a night, bolts out the next day, and writes exactly the same story that 300 reporters before him or her have written. And to the point where most islanders can pretty much predict what a story is going to say about them.
They're pretty media savvy there.
They are. They're very media savvy, and they have a spokesman in their mayor who is extremely media savvy, really a well-spoken guy. Yeah, so I think there's always some skepticism whenever a reporter shows up that he's going to or she's going to be able to get it right or do something different, at least, from anything that's been done. I rented a place, for one thing. You know, I wasn't staying at one of the B&Bs. Once word got around that Cindy Parks, a lady on the island, had rented her second floor to this guy who was going to come in to write a book, that went a long way to kind of establishing my bona fides with the islanders. And then the first month and a half, I really devoted myself to doing nothing but kind of showing the flag. I rode my bike everywhere. I showed up at church four times plus a week, you know, 4 hours plus a week. And, you know, whenever there was a town meeting, I was there. Whenever there was any sort of social occasion, I was there. Showed up every day for the afternoon coffee clatch of old timers, which they call the Situation Room. I became impossible to miss. And I always had a notebook in my hand. And, you know, Tangier is a place where everybody has a role to play and accountability is unavoidable. And my role became, I was the guy writing the book. So after about a month and a half, that skepticism started to fall away, and I was embraced as an islander with a specific role. And
you were there to report on the work that goes on Tangier. What was that like for you? And what was the biggest thrill when it comes to that?
There were times when I stepped on a boat in weather that I wasn't sure was so smart to go out in, but I was with islanders who are, they have to be among the most able boat handlers on the Chesapeake, if not in the entire country. I mean, these are guys who take these little wooden boats, shallow draft boats, out into weather regardless of the weather. You know, you don't get makeup days in the crabbing season. You got to go. You know, they have families to keep, and so they'll go out in 4 and 5 and even 6 foot seas on occasion. They'll complain about it an awful lot, but they'll go. And so I found myself oystering in the middle of December in 4 foot seas at least, 35 knot winds. And it was a white knuckle experience for me. I was scared beyond speech, I got to tell you. That boat was rolling around like a carnival ride. The guys I was with were so calm and capable that, you know, I never lost my faith that I was going to get out of it alive.
Did they like to play with you a little bit because you were an outsider to maybe give you more thrill than you had asked for?
Like they will, they tend to understate things a bit, you know. So you go out, you go emerge from the protection of the island into a crosswind that's, you know, 40 miles an hour, and someone will turn to you and say, it's breezy. But that's about as far as they took it. They never tried to make me purposely uncomfortable, I don't think.
Do the Islanders tell you that they encourage their kids to move away after high school? Do they say to their children, you don't want to live here? You know, there's not a lot of future here. This is probably our last home on Tangier.
Do they say it overtly? I don't know. I think that's a real dilemma in an awful lot of families, because the population is poised to nosedive, and it's been sinking pretty steadily for decades now, and there will come a time when the island will reach tipping points for its provision of essential services. And yeah, I don't know where those tipping points are, but they're getting closer all the time. So on the one hand, you've got families, moms and dads, who look at their kids and they see that those kids staying on the island is the key to the continuation of an experiment that's been going on for 240 years now, that their entire family has been wrapped up in for 9 generations. You know, everybody can trace his or her lineage back to one guy, Joseph Crockett, who showed up in 1778. And all that history goes by the wayside if Tangier has to be abandoned, or, you know, they just lose too many people. On the other hand, those same moms and dads look around at the difficulties and uncertainties of life on the water, and especially with the prospect of college and such as an alternative. I think they're hard-pressed to argue that their kids should follow the ways of their forebears and stick around. So I think you see a great wrestling match occurring inside a lot of Tangier parents, because the things that they wish for the most, two things they wish for the most, are in, you know, direct opposition to each other. And what you do see, though, the proof's in the pudding, I guess, because what you do see is very few kids remaining on the island. And, you know, it used to be the boys would quit school at 16 to follow their fathers onto the water. At 20 or 21, they'd get their own boats. They could, the boats would cost $20,000 to $25,000. They could get a bank to write them a note for the entire amount, and all of that's changed. Boats are impossibly expensive now. The banks won't loan you a penny towards them. So getting on the water is difficult, and boys consequently stay in school. They, almost to a one, they and the girls leave the island after graduation for either the military or for college, and they don't come back. There's nothing for them to come back to. There are no jobs.
You get into some really interesting questions in the book. One I had from reading it was, why not just move to Chrisfield? You can still be a waterman. You could still do what you do on Tangier.
Well, you know, I think over the last few years, there are probably some Tangiermen who would love to do that. But how do you sell a house on a sinking, shrinking island? I mean, where do you get the grub stake necessary to put down the down payment on a place on the mainland? All of your assets are tied up in what you have in a crab house, in shedding tanks, and in a house that you may have inherited from your parents or your grandparents on this little island. And there's no way to liquidate that and to put it to use elsewhere. It's a fixed asset, and you're stuck. So that's the dilemma. I mean, they can't get off.
An easy assumption for people to make is that the government, if it is the government to do this, probably most likely it is the government that would do something like this, is build a seawall that the islanders feel would extend the life of Tangier. But how can we justify doing that for under 500 people? And you get to this really interesting philosophical question about what's worth saving. Is it just a place for 500 people to live, or is it something so special in our history, in our culture, in the regional culture, that we should save it? I was wondering, was that a question or a conclusion that you were surprised that you came to?
Yeah. It's one that developed over my time there. And I'm not sure where I fall on it yet. I don't know. I mean, I know that I would love to see Tangier saved, because I love the place and I love the people. You know, and I was fully invested in the community while I lived there. And you can't have that experience and not be touched by it. I mean, it's impossible. And any reporter who suggests that they can remain, you know, utterly unmoved by a story like that they're so deeply embedded in is lying to you. But I don't know whether it should be saved. And the issue with Tangier, I mean, Tangier's going to, it presents us this difficult decision. that we have to make as a country and as a people, and that is, given that thousands, certainly hundreds, probably thousands of communities are going to be facing exactly this in the decades to come, and that this is just the first of many, and given that we don't have the money, the technical means, or the time to save all of those imperiled places, how do we develop a rubric, a system of decision-making so that we can figure out which places we save and which places we surrender? And Tangiers, it's not a perfect first place to base our future decisions on because, you know, it's got a declining population. It's tiny to begin with. It would cost buckets of money to save. But it is the first place. It's what's been presented to us. And so what we have to do is come up with that rubric. And it will have to include stuff other than just headcount. You know, if you base, I mean, it's easy to say, okay, let's save Miami because there are millions of people that live there. Of course, you're going to do what you can to save a place like that.
Or Ocean City, Maryland.
Or Ocean City. Well, maybe not so much Ocean City, but certainly Baltimore, certainly New Orleans, certainly New York. You know, places that have a real critical mass of humanity, infrastructure that is irreplaceable.
Okay. I was just thinking about all that property that's been built in Ocean City over the years. People have millions and billions of dollars tied up in that.
That's true. And maybe some people find great cultural value in Ocean City as well. Who knows?
Maybe some people do.
Anyway. Who knows? But anyway, you have to, you know, so you have to decide, okay, is it strictly going to be a function of population that's going to be the basis of what we save? Or are there places in America that we consider sacred, basically, that we consider really important to who we are as a people, that might be really small? And the thing about Tangier is that, yes, it's really, really small, but because it's an outlier, because it is truly unlike any other community in the United States, its very existence helps define the breadth of who we are as Americans. It is the circumference of the circle in which most of us live towards the middle. But here are some people that live way out on the edge, and because they do, they have kind of a unique value as, you know, the outliers count. They the shape of us is due to the outliers. And so it's, you know, I hope people far smarter than me come up with this rubric because I have no idea how we go about deciding how to place value on the intangibles that define a place.
You're listening to Roughly Speaking. More with our guest, Earl Swift, after this message.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.
Just take a minute for me on the science. I'm always told, when it comes to what's happening in the Chesapeake Bay, what's happened to the islands already that have disappeared, what's happening to Tangier and other places, is that it's a combination of things. Sea level rise and land sinking. That's the science I've been told, in short, in brief. That's your understanding of it, but that's not the understanding of most islanders?
Well, the islanders, a lot of their learning, a lot of their belief is based on anecdotal evidence, what they see, what they experience. And just as Tangier crabbers differ with scientists a great deal on the you know, the habits of the blue crab and the health of the fishery, because they see something every day that the scientists speak about in the abstract, they do differ with climate scientists insofar as they feel that what has claimed places like Holland Island, Poplar Island before it was rebuilt, Jane's Island, and Tangier is simple erosion. That wind-driven waves, particularly from the west, have been chipping away at the island's edges for lo these many centuries, and these waves have whittled Tangier down from a much larger size, three times bigger at the time of the Civil War, to its present very small dimensions. And sure, erosion has had a huge effect, but if erosion and sea level rise are not mutually exclusive phenomena. They're interlinked. The higher the bay comes up, the more destructive the wave action from any direction. The instructive thing to do if you're a doubter about Tangier is to take a helicopter or a small plane over the island. This is a place with soft edges. It's a marsh island. So there's really no, there's no easy way to see water rising up along the shore. There's no hard shore against which to measure its progress. But what you do see is marsh drowning. And if you stand, as most islanders will, looking out over the marsh that occupies most of Tangier's middle, it appears to be an unvarying whole of bronze grasses in the winter, light green in the summer, blowing in the breeze. When you go up, when you elevate yourself a few hundred feet and look down on it, what you see is that it is not a whole at all. It has been reduced to a loose macrame of strands of marsh punctuated by big and getting bigger bodies of water. It's a lacework. So what's happening here is that sea level rise is slowly drowning the marsh, well, quickly drowning the marsh, steadily drowning the marsh from inside as well as from out. So not, you know, Tangiermen look for measures of their island getting smaller around the edges. What's going to do them in is the way the marsh is drowning from within, and Tangier is just dissolving. It's falling to bits. It'll very soon be three islands, and you know, you will not be able to get from one to the other without a boat. And you know, after that, those islands will, the uplands on the island will revert to marsh, and then in time that marsh will, as the marsh is now, revert to mud flat and then open water. So it's a much sneakier process than we might picture. The island is gradually becoming soupier and soupier, and that's the way the end will come.
In all this time you spent there, what was your favorite moment?
How about I give you a couple or three? Because coming down with one is going to be tough. But I went out oystering in November of 2016 with a very capable Tangier waterman named Lonnie Moore. We went out in the Rappahannock River, and he is just an expert boat handler and a very aggressive oysterman. And we found ourselves in the middle of about 30 boats doing these tight turns over the oyster rock. And it was as close to being in the Battle of Britain that I think I'll ever experience. These boats were missing each other by like 4 and 5 feet, going full bore, just trying to jockey for position over this oyster rock. None of them giving any leeway to the others. And it was exciting and terrifying and just exhilarating as all get out. And then after we were done, we were back in Tangier few days later, and Lonnie had a handful of oysters that he had kept for himself from the catch, and he chucked one and handed it to me. And you know, I mean, it's always nice to have a fresh oyster, but I mean, you can't get fresher than having the captain of the boat hand you the oyster and sucking it right down there on the deck. So that was one. There were many times when people just treated me with great kindness and that I didn't have any reason to expect and didn't necessarily deserve, and that for which I'll always be grateful. But I did the first reading about from the book on Tangier on August 11th of this year, right after the book came out. It's my first return to the island since the book was published, and a whole bunch of islanders turned out for the reading, which was held in the auditorium at the school. And we got to the Q&A at the end, and instead of asking questions, islander after islander stood up and offered testimony. It was like being in church at Swain Memorial United Methodist. They offered testimony about me and about the book. There were tears. People got choked up. It was just this electrifying, deeply moving, incredibly gratifying experience that I
did not see. Were they expressing appreciation for the work you did?
Yes, yes. And it became clear in what they said that, you know, the fact that the book was warts and all, the fact that it does not paint them in an unvaryingly great light, but captured the Tangier they knew to be true, was what they valued. That somebody told what they thought was the truth. And
did you get any complaints about the title?
No, I didn't. I had a few people ask me what Requiem meant, but no complaints.
That's great. That's very gratifying. Was there another moment? Best home-cooked meal you had on the island? Or maybe it was that oyster.
Well, you know, in the same kind of ballpark as the oyster, when I had a softshell crab, piece of softshell crab handed to me fresh from the fryer at Fisherman's Wharf when I was back in the kitchen one day. And I just watched Uker Eskridge, the guy who caught that crab, hand that crab over to the woman, Stuart Parks, who then fried it. You know, that completed a chain of possession, you know, a farm-to-table sort of provenance that, you know, the likes of which I had never experienced and that you're not likely to find anywhere unless you're a crabber yourself. And that was pretty magical. There were a lot of moments, laugh-out-loud, funny moments in the Situation Room where these old-timers would get to telling stories about, you know, islanders in the past and such that I remember very fondly. And
do you feel like you've written an elegy in advance?
You know, this is a story that had to be told now or couldn't be told because things are moving fast. And the nature of sea level rise is not a straight line on the graph. It's a parabolic curve, and it gets steeper and faster as we go. And what took 50 years to happen to Holland Island in the late 19th century and early 20th now happens in five. I mean, we're going to see within our lifetimes profound changes to the coasts, and it's going to affect everybody, not just the people on those coasts. You know, you mentioned the refugees earlier. There will be refugees, and there won't just be 460 of them from Tangier. There will be an army of them, and that will affect everyone. That will affect the folks living in Iowa as. Maybe not quite as profoundly as the folks living in the Tidewater, but no one gets out of this.
Earl, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's a pleasure.
As a Virginia-based reporter and author, Earl Swift has written about the Chesapeake region and the Tidewater for the better part of 30 years. Chesapeake Requiem, published by HarperCollins, is his seventh book. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes journalist John Judas, discussing his new book, The Nationalist Revival, Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization, a study of nationalism from its modern origins in the 1880s to its resurgence today. Tuesday, October 9th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.